listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Dylan Thomas, the Welsh poet, premiered Under Milkwood before a live audience at New York's 92nd Street Y in 1953, the only recording of Thomas reading his great radio play. This Sunday, the 92nd Street Y celebrates Dylan Thomas's centenary with Michael Sheen, the notable Welsh actor, directing the reading. It'll be broadcast live by BBC Radio Wales on October 26th at 3 p.m. The 92Y will live stream the audio online, and WNYC will offer an encore broadcast and webcast on Sunday, November 2nd. I'm very pleased to welcome Michael Sheen to our show today. Hello.
Hello. It's a pleasure to be here.
How did you get involved with this 92nd Street Y production? And are you surprised that it was premiered here in New York and not in England?
It's extraordinary. Well, I don't know about England.
Or Wales. Okay.
Wales, maybe. Dylan Thomas was doing a series of tours to America. His first appearance at the Y was in 1950. And he would do these sort of readings, not only of his own work, but of other poets, or Shakespeare, Yeats, people like that, Thomas Hardy, who was a great favorite of his. And he would do these tours of university campuses and poetry centers around America. And he was sort of hailed as a rock star. Sort of hard to imagine that now, but he was very, very popular, very charismatic. He had a wonderful reading voice. Not all poets can read their own poetry or other people's poetry.
And we'll hear a little bit of him later.
Mm. Oh, great. There's a fantastic series of recordings by Cadmon, who have the only recording of Dylan Thomas reading Under Milkwood from the Y performance in May of 1953. And that was only because someone just at the very last second thought to put a tape recorder down in front of him. Otherwise, we wouldn't have a recording of him doing it at all. But I grew up in Port Talbot in South Wales, which is right next to Swansea, where Dylan Thomas grew up in the uplands there. So Dylan Thomas is a huge figure for me growing up through my childhood.
Well, you also grew up in Liverpool for a time.
For a very short time, but I don't speak
about it. Would Dylan Thomas have even been mentioned in the schools in England, or did you have to wait to go
home to
Wales?
Dylan Thomas became—he sort of fell out of favor, really, as a popular poet at a certain period of time. He was very difficult to kind of categorize him. I think early on he was seen as being possibly part of the sort of Fitzrovia bohemian set. He was taken on by Edith Sitwell and was sort of championed by her and other poets at the time. And he was sort of seen as a sort of surrealist. But I think he was always a very popular poet, but people tended to not take him as seriously in the years following, sort of after his death. And I hope that this centenary and all the celebrations that are going on for him at the moment sort of revitalize an interest in him as a truly remarkable poet.
You appeared in a BBC production of Under Milkwood in May. Have you done this any other times?
I think every child in Wales grows up doing Under Milkwood at some point. The first production I was involved with was at my school when I was probably about 14 years old, and not really knowing what on earth I was doing in it or what any of it was about, but it sounded rather good. And I've been involved in various productions of it over the years, and I've written in the style of it. I've written essays about Dylan Thomas. I've performed his. I've been asked to perform his poetry at different times. My own father asked me to read one of his poems, "And Death Shall Have No Dominion," at my grandfather's funeral. So he's always, his words and his poetry, I've always found are sort of appropriate for certain points in my life when it's very difficult to put into words how you feel about certain things. And he seems to be able to, in his extraordinary imagery and his extraordinary sensuality for words and life, is able to express the inexpressible at times.
Now, you mentioned that children perform this. It takes place in the fictional town of Radegob, but that really is an obscenity spelled backwards.
Well, yes, it was a very good attempt at pronouncing it.
It's the closest I come to Welsh.
Yeah. Well, the double L sound, which that word begins with, is usually pronounced with a.
No.
It's pronounced with a. Oh. And so it would be Llregib. If you spell it backwards, it suddenly has a different meaning. And it's a sort of...
Bugger all. I'm willing to say it here. The FCC will allow me to say that. That's an offensive term throughout the UK.
It's not really offensive. It's a little bit saucy. It's sort of naughty rather than offensive. And I think Dylan Thomas eventually found it a little bit silly and maybe a little bit lightweight. It was something that he and his friends, Dan Jones and Fred Jaynes and people like that, who he grew up with, used to take great pleasure in coming up with this sort of silly, sort of saucy punning that they would do on words.
Since Welsh words are so difficult to pronounce, is that why you have only Welsh actors appearing in this, or Welsh-related actors?
Well, the original production, the original performance at the Y was done by Dylan Thomas and five other performers, all of which were American actors who worked at the Y. It was a sort of fairly hastily put together thing. He was actually finishing writing the last bit of it just as the actors were preparing to go on stage. He was forced into a room by Elizabeth Reitel, who was sort of overseeing him and made to finish writing the last few pages. And the pages were handed to the actors as they walked out onto the stage. In fact, there was a wonderful letter that that was received at the Y recently by a lady who was there at the original performance. I think she was 15 years old when she saw it. And she said that apparently John Malcolm Brennan, who was the director of the Poetry Centre at the time, her memory is that he came out on stage and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be a little delayed because the writer is just finishing the piece in the wings." Now, I don't know if that's true. That's the first time I've heard that, but that was by someone who was actually there. So that's that gives you a sense of how it was put together. And listening to that recording is extraordinary because, of course, it's the first time anyone had really heard Under Milk Wood.
And the audience, they were reading it without rehearsing.
And the audience don't know how to take it. They don't know how to respond to it, whether this is a serious poet, this is an extraordinary man, and yet things seem to be very funny in it as well. And so you can hear, as the reading goes on, the audience starting to laugh a little bit at things, not sure whether they should laugh, and eventually they're just guffawing. It's sort of roars of laughter coming across. And that's one of the extraordinary things about the piece, I think, is that it has some of the most beautiful lyrical and dark imagery, but also some of the most sort of ribald and really kind of close to the edge humor as well. It's full of life.
One of your cast members is Kate Burton, the daughter of Sybil Williams and Richard Burton, who starred in the play's first BBC radio recording.
That's right. Well, the BBC were going to do, or were always planning to do, a major radio performance of it. And, of course, Dylan Thomas, after he did the performances in May at the Y in 1953 and again came back in October, by November the 9th, he was dead. He died here in New York. And so the first radio production was done just a few months later in 1954 in London. And Richard Burton, who was a great friend of Dylan Thomas, took on the part of First Voice, which Dylan would have done himself.
And you're doing First Voice.
That's correct.
In this new production.
And it's wonderful that Richard's daughter, Kate Burton, who's an extraordinary actress in her own right, is going to be a part of this performance.
Do we learn different things about the play from the way Burton interpreted it as opposed to how Thomas read it?
Well, when you listen to Dylan Thomas do it himself, obviously it's an authoritative reading of the text. This is the man who wrote it, so all the intentions, all the inflections, everything about it, you tend to take as being, you know, how it should be. Dylan Thomas, when he reads it, has an extraordinary sense of the meter, of the rhythm of the verse. It sounds to our ears now maybe a little declaimed. But then he was performing to a live audience, even though it's a play for voices and it was being recorded. That particular performance was for a live audience, so it's possibly a little more declaimed because of that. When you listen to Richard Burton do it, of course, it's purely for a radio audience. He's been described, that voice is extraordinary, and he's been described as breathing the piece, and it is very intimate. The relationship between that First Voice character as he takes you through the town and introduces you first to the dreams of all the characters and then to their daily life and 24 hours in the cycle of the life of this village. Having Richard Burton's voice inside your head is the perfect accompaniment. You know, so Dylan Thomas, when you hear him do it, just to sort of take the beginning of it, it begins with the famous lines, "To begin at the beginning." And Dylan Thomas sort of is more like sort of, "To begin at the beginning, it is spring, moonless night in the small town." Now, Burton is more like, "To begin at the beginning, it is spring, moonless night in the small town." So, you can tell that it's a very different kind of sense.
That's a very good Richard Burton, by the way.
Well, I've had many years.
You've also read The Hunchback in the Park for the BBC. He did Thomas did a number of appearances, as you said, at the 92nd Street Y, and we have a little bit of him reading Do Not Go Gently Into That Good Night from 1953, and we thought we would play it just to give our audience a sense of what Dylan Thomas sounded like.
Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rave at close of day. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Though wise men at their end, no dark is right, because their words had forked no lightning they. Do not go gentle into that good night. Good men the last wave by, crying how bright their frail deeds might have danced in a green bay. Rage, rage against the dying of the light.
A pretty famous line, rage, rage against the dying of the light. He obviously did a certain amount of declaiming when he read his poetry, but that was very effective.
It certainly was. He, you know, as I say, when he went and did live performances of his poetry, the response from the audience was extraordinary. I mean, like I say, he was sort of like a rock star. And that particular poem was written partly in response to his own father's death. His father was a big figure in his life. His father was an English teacher at the school that he went to when he was a child, and had a very large effect on Dylan Thomas.
To people who are unfamiliar with it, could you describe Under Milkwood?
Well, Under Milkwood is a play for voices. He once described it as an entertainment out of the darkness.
So a play for voices is what happens when it's staged? Does an actor then kind of fill in, or do you just simply do it still as a radio play?
Well, there's been many live stage performances of it. I always feel that the ones that I've seen have always been not wholly successful in communicating the piece, I think, because it was written for voice. So suddenly the words take slightly second place when you're watching the visuals of it. So the performance that Dylan did at the Y was just with the actors standing behind lecterns and performing the piece. And I think that's how it works most effectively as a play for voices. It's the story of a village, Milkwood, and they live under Milkwood. The village is called Lloregib, but the Milkwood is the wood in the village, and they live under Milkwood, literally. And we hear the character of First Voice, who's our narrator. Dylan Thomas described that character as possibly a guardian angel who just, I always think of the Bruno Ganz character in Wim Wenders' Wings of Desire, just standing listening in to the dreams and the wishes and the fantasies and the everyday realities of the people in the town. And we listen to the 24-hour cycle of this village, the night, them dreaming, them waking up, the village coming to life, and all the different characters going about their day, and then finally coming back to dusk, into the night again, and back into the darkness of the night.
And your role is First Voice.
That's right. Well, Dylan Thomas originally read First Voice. He also read the part of the Reverend Eli Jenkins, who discourses and gives his sermons and his prayers about the village at certain times. But the challenge of doing it with six people, which is what I'm doing, I'm replicating what Dylan Thomas did originally, is that there are a lot of parts. There's many, many, many characters. So each of the actors has to play multiple characters, and at times you have to try and make sure that you're not speaking to yourself at any point, which is a bit tricky. So I end up playing more characters than Dylan Thomas did originally.
And all the actors will be Welsh? Did you have to fly them in? Or?
Yep, all the actors are coming over from Britain. I wanted to make sure that all the actors who were performing in it were Welsh. Also, we have quite a short time to rehearse this, so I wanted to make sure that they had a familiarity with the piece already. So that's another reason why they're all Welsh actors. And all of them are people who I've either known for a long time or have worked with before. Two of the actors, Francine and Matthew, also took part in a production that I did in my hometown in Port Talbot in South Wales called The Passion a few years ago. So I've worked with them both before. So.
Is there something about Wales that's produced so many famous actors? Ray Milland, Richard Burton, Glynis Johns, Anthony Hopkins, Jonathan Pryce, Christian Bale, you?
The
longer
no
list than that. It's a pretty impressive
name. I mean, you can list lots of famous actors from anywhere, any country, I would imagine. I think what's extraordinary is that the town I come from, Port Talbot, which is a very small town on the South Wales coast next to Swansea, where Dylan Thomas came from, has produced both Richard Burton and Anthony Hopkins, as well as myself. But I don't put myself in the same league as them. But just to know that from one small town, which is a very old working-class steel town, really, with tin mines way back, not really a tradition that you'd imagine that would produce great actors, and yet Richard Burton and Anthony Hopkins both come from there. So I don't really know why. There's certainly a musicality about the Welsh. There's a storytelling tradition. They tend to be very good storytellers, quite animated, quite passionate. The sort of reserve that the English maybe are known for stereotypically is certainly not something that the Welsh are known for. They're much more passionate, much more colourful in their language, and they do love words. And that was the one thing that Dylan Thomas said to his actors on that very first performance, just before they went out. He said, "Love the words, love the words." And that's a very Welsh trait, I think.
My guest is Michael Sheen, who is directing and performing in a reading of Under Milkwood this Sunday at the 92nd Street Y, celebrating Dylan Thomas's centenary. It will be broadcast live by BBC Radio Wales on October 26th at 3 p.m. That's this Sunday, right?
Mm-hmm.
And also 92Y will live stream the audio online. WNYC will offer an encore broadcast and webcast on Sunday, November 2nd. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. Michael Sheen is directing and performing in a centenary celebration production of Dylan Thomas's great radio play Under Milkwood. It premiered at the 92nd Street Y in 1953, and it is being performed this Sunday again at the 92nd Street Y. It'll be broadcast on the BBC Radio Wales at 3 p.m. And then it'll also be live streamed on 92Y. And we will be rebroadcasting it and webcasting it on Sunday, November 2nd here at WNYC. We actually have a little clip of the introduction of Dylan Thomas reading Under Milkwood from that performance in 1953. Should we listen to it?
Wonderful.
To begin at the beginning. It is spring, moonless night in the small town. Starless and Bible black, the cobble streets silent, and the hunched quarters and rabbit's wood limping invisible down to the slow black, crow black fishing boat bobbing sea.
Even speaking English, he threw in some of those Welsh sounds. Mm. Do you find this play distinctly Welsh?
It is, absolutely. I've always found that work that is incredibly specific, as this is, then the more specific it is, the more at a certain point it sort of flips into becoming universal as well. And I think that's very much the case of this. It's about the life cycle of any town, of any village, and it has a lot to say, not just about the specifics of Welsh village life, but also of just universal life, which I think is one of the great strengths of Dylan Thomas, that he drew so much on very specific things about his childhood, his what he experienced in life, but was able to somehow speak on a kind of cosmic level as well, which I always find so inspiring.
I've heard that the town, the fictional town he's created here, is based on Larne, Wales, and I hope I pronounced that correctly. Mm. But it's interesting that Larne is spelled L-A-U-G-H-A-R-N-E.
Mm.
Was it hard learning to speak English after growing up?
It's an amalgamation of places, really. The sort of growth, the development of the piece of Under Milkwood sort of took roughly 10 years, I suppose. You can sort of see elements of it starting to develop in things that he wrote about in letters. He made a visit to a place called Newquay in Wales as well, which is a fishing village.
Certain characters showed up in earlier works.
Yes, he was very struck by Newquay. Also Larne, where he and his wife Caitlin went to live, full of life, full of extraordinary characters. So it was a sort of a combination of the two of those places. He wrote a story called Quite Early One Morning, which had certainly elements of Under Milkwood in it as well. But for a long time, he described the play as being something that he was going to call The Town That Was Mad. And it was the idea for it was originally going to be a town where all the characters have an inspector come from London to see whether they're sane or not. And they're clearly mad. And yet, as you start to listen to them, you realize that it's the rest of the world that are mad. And they are the only ones who are sane. And that was a sort of an idea that he had going on. And that's still in there in the piece. But it started to become something much bigger than that, much more universal than that. And I think had he not died, obviously, at the end of 53, he had plans to keep working on it. It was something that wasn't really finished. People talk about the idea that it takes about two-thirds of the play for everyone to wake up and then a very short time for them to go through the day and go back to bed again. And I think the night section of the play was something that Dylan Thomas would have relished writing about. So much of his personal life happened in the nighttime, and it was something that he was very drawn to, and I think he would have extended that. There were plans for more songs. There's some music in it, some singing in it, and he would have done more with that and expanded certain characters and gone back into that nightlife in the pub and that kind of stuff. And so I
always
think
in the pub.
Always in the pub. So I think it would have been something that would have kept developing after his death as well. And, you know, we know that he was planning to write an opera with Stravinsky next. That was going to be the next project. He was writing more film scripts. He was going to think about doing more dramatic pieces, writing more plays. And his poetry was certainly changing as well. And it was a huge tragedy that he never saw the age of 40. I mean, it's extraordinary to think that this man, you know, died at the age of 39 and produced what he did manage to produce, which is an extraordinary body of work.
Now, you did you become interested in acting early or in your life, or did you have dreams of becoming a professional soccer player?
Yeah, I played a lot of soccer, football as we call it in Britain, when I was growing up, and that was my big passion. When I sort of reached my apotheosis of that at about the age of 12, and it was downhill after that. But I did have interest to go professional at that point when I was very young. But it would have meant leaving Wales and going to London very young, all my family coming with me, and that wasn't something that was going to happen. So I sort of transferred my passions then to acting, which had some interest in my family. My parents and my uncles and aunties and grandparents had taken part in sort of amateur operatic productions, Gilbert and Sullivan and the great musicals, and so I'd grown up watching that kind of thing. And I suppose that must have given me a taste for it. And then I was very fortunate I got to join an extraordinary youth theatre, the Westcombe Morgan Youth Theatre in my local area. And it was only subsequently I realised that that's quite possibly one of the greatest youth theatres in the world. It was an amazing training for me without really realising that that's what was going on.
But then eventually you did go to London for drama school.
And then when I was
18,
yes,
well,
I went to RADA, the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art in London, and for 3 years and had a wonderful training there, and then went on to become a professional actor after that.
And then as a professional actor, you got to play Brian Clough in the Damned United. So
that's right, the
back
two worlds
to, back to football.
That's right, yeah. That was the one time I had a chance to bring my love of football and my love of acting together.
What, did you come to England with a Welsh accent?
Yes, my accent was, I think, very strong when I first got to RADA, and we had to learn to, not to get rid of it, but to be able to lose it, you know, for different parts. And I'd love to hear, I remember when I got to RADA, the dialect teacher there, the voice coach there, did recordings of people, because she said that you know, people's voices changed so quickly once they got to drama school. People were coming with all these wonderful regional accents, and within a fairly short space of time they were all learning to speak very posh, and so she would record them immediately, so she had examples of these accents, you know, to be able to teach to other people. And I remember she did a recording of me, and I'd love to hear that now, because I don't know what it would sound like. I did recently, rather embarrassingly, watch the very first TV interview that I did. When I left drama school, I did a play. I was very lucky. I did a play called When She Danced in the West End, and I was playing opposite Vanessa Redgrave, the wonderful actress Vanessa Redgrave, and it was an extraordinary start for me. And so I was interviewed on the television, on local Welsh television, I remember, whilst we were doing the performance. And I hadn't seen this interview since, I don't think I'd ever seen it, but my mum and dad had recorded it, and we were watching some old video. I was showing my daughter, she came back to Wales for Christmas with me a year ago, and we were showing her this video that we'd made when I was a kid. And when that particular video finished, suddenly there was obviously something underneath it. You know, there's something that had been recorded over, and this interview appeared. To my horror, I sounded... I was the most embarrassing thing I've ever seen in my life, and I was speaking in this very affected way that I obviously thought you had to do when you were on the television or something. My daughter thought it was the funniest thing she's ever seen, and I will never live it down.
But British actors wind up doing accents in a way that most of the rest of us don't even this country, we have many regional accents, but it's not the same. In England, for example, you can go 12 miles away from one town and hear a totally different accent. Or in a city like London, you can go from one neighborhood to another and hear totally different accents. So British actors really have to learn accents. Has it been easy for you? After all, now you do a Midwestern accent on Masters of Sex. American accent.
Britain, of course, is a much smaller place, so the diversity of accents is much more compressed than it would be in America, I suppose. I've had to play a lot of real people people who've actually lived, you know, people like Tony Blair and David Frost and characters
and
like
Mozart.
That. And Mozart, although no one's really, you know, holding me to how Mozart actually sounded. So what I mean by that is that I've played people that the audience is familiar with. They know how they sound. They know what they look like. So I've had to work very specifically on their, not just their accent, but their voices. And that's what I found is that you can't really separate someone's accent from who they are, how they express themselves through their voice and through their body. And the accent is just one very small part. Usually, there's very few people I've ever come across who I've worked on as an actor that have a pure accent. It's usually there's a little bit of this and a bit of that, or you can hear where they've been influenced by this, or they're trying to sound like this, or, you know, so you have to understand someone sort of totally holistically, I think, rather than splitting them up into accents.
And how long does it take to master someone's voice? You obviously don't want to do the equivalent of a comedian doing Tony Blair or David Frost. You have to wind up embodying that person.
Well, like I just said, it's a holistic thing. It's not, you can't separate out the voice or the accent or anything like that. It's about a total expression of who they are and what's going on underneath, and the interplay between what's going on internally for them, what they want people to experience about them, and how those two things can sometimes conflict. And so you have to, I've always worked on it in that way, so I don't separate it out. I don't think of it as trying to master their voice. It's about working on them as a character and what is the story that they're telling.
When did you come to the United States to perform? Was it for Amadeus in 1999?
Yes, I was doing a production of Amadeus. We'd done it at the Old Vic Theatre in London for 6 months, and then we came to America with it and eventually performed it for 6 months here. It was the wonderful actor David Suchet was playing Salieri, and I was playing Mozart. I had a wonderful time here on Broadway. It was a great experience. And then me and my partner at the time, Kate, we had our daughter, Lily. She was... she had her first birthday here in New York, and that was over the millennium, I remember, as well. So we celebrated the going into the new millennium here. And then Kate was doing more film work at the time, and so we ended up spending a bit of time in Los Angeles and decided that we would sort of stay there for a little while. And then when me and Kate broke up, we decided to stay there. That's where Lily has been brought up, and so I've lived there now for the last 12, 13 years, and my daughter's 15 now. It's gone incredibly quickly.
And you're connected to a well-known funny lady.
Yes. My partner, Sarah Silverman, yes.
You've collaborated on 5 films with the writer Peter Morgan. Is that just luck or because they've been wonderful things?
Well, it began with the first time I ever played Tony Blair. It was a TV film called The Deal, which was about Blair and Gordon Brown and the supposed deal they made when they were moving towards becoming the sort of leadership of the Labour Party whilst they were still in opposition. And that was directed by the great director Stephen Frears, and was sort of the first time really that an audience had been asked to take seriously a dramatic portrayal of contemporary political characters as opposed to something satirical or as you said, comedians or impersonators doing it. We were very unsure whether it would be accepted, you know, at that point. But it was a huge success in Britain and led to us then working on The Queen, the film that Helen Mirren famously played the Queen in, and I reprised the role of Tony Blair, again written by Peter Morgan, directed by Stephen Frears. And so through working with Peter on those two projects, We struck up a very good relationship, and we seemed to kind of suit each other's needs in different ways. He is a writer and me as an actor. And so he told me that he was writing a stage play. Whilst we were filming The Queen, actually, he said, I'm writing a stage play, and it's about David Frost and Richard Nixon. I'd love you to have a look at it. And so that's how that began. And then they just sort of kept rolling in, then The Damned United, and then finally the last time I played Blair, which was The Special Relationship about he and Bill Clinton.
And you weren't worried about being typecast as being Tony Blair the rest of your life, or a Blair-like figure?
Not really, no. I've played, you know, such a range of parts and characters, and intend to carry on doing that, so it seems to have worked out okay.
Did you ever hear back from Tony Blair? Did he like the way you played
him? I think officially he said that he hadn't watched any of them, and I think I understand why you would do that, because he doesn't want to be asked questions about the truth of any given particular situation in it, you know, so it's a lot easier for him to say he hasn't watched it. But I did meet him once. On the whole, I tend to not try and meet the people I play if they're real people and still alive. Certainly not early on, because I don't want to be compromised in any way on how I approach the character. And sometimes meeting the actual person can affect that. So I've tended to stay away from it. But I did meet Blair just before we started doing the last one, before we did Special Relationship, and just to get a smell of him, you know, as an animal, and just to see how he
did that help?
Moves the air in the room and how people react to him and that kind of stuff. And yeah, it certainly did. I think it did make a difference.
What about Frost? You really did nail David Frost. He was a guest on the show. Tony Blair's been a guest on the show as well, but I wasn't here that day, so I still haven't gotten a smell of him as an animal.
Well, David Frost was an extraordinary man as well, and you know, I came to become very fond of him. I stayed away from meeting him early on, but once we'd been performing the play for a little while, and I felt like I had my journey, I knew where I was going, I knew the sort of character I was playing, and I was able to separate him, the character, from the actual person. And so Sir David became involved with the production. He came to watch filming, and he met my parents. I came to know him, you know, personally, and I had a great affection for him. It was very, very sad when he died recently.
And now you're also known to a lot of Americans as Dr. William Masters and the Showtime series Masters of Sex. You were quoted in the New York Times regarding that role as saying, I only ever play myself with the volume turned up on certain aspects. If I was playing anyone else, I'd be acting, and I hate acting. Well, considering the fact that Dr. Masters is often an unpleasant character, what aspects of you turn up in him?
Well, it seems that lots of people that I talk to about this character seem to have extraordinary, exemplary lives. No one seems to want to admit that they have any, you know, awful qualities. I was fascinated and very drawn to playing a character where I could explore all the things that I'm unhappy about myself, that I don't feel comfortable about. I mean, I think most people tend to spend their lives trying to convince everyone around them that they're wonderful people and that they only do wonderful things and they only have wonderful qualities. That's not my experience of myself, and it's certainly not my experience of anyone else. So I was really drawn to playing a character who wouldn't necessarily be obviously likable, but hopefully would be all the more human for that. And I think the way television is at the moment, the way the standard of writing and the audience response to certain, you know, stories now, I think it allowed a much more exploratory way of looking at character, rather than just playing characters on the kind of likable, unlikable Venn diagram. I wanted to really challenge people and take the audience on a real journey with this man, hopefully over a long period of time.
I half expected to see you come in wearing a bow tie.
I nearly did.
In that New York Times article, Maureen Dowd wrote that you rated William Masters as more important than some of the other characters you've played, including David Frost, Tony Blair, Mozart?
I don't remember what I said about that.
Well, but you must have been feeling good about William Masters that day.
Well, I think that's just my response to that, hearing that now, is that I would say what's important about him is that he is not obviously likable, that he challenges an audience and requires audience members to have to really examine their own selfishness, their own ego, their own ambition, their own duplicity, their own manipulation, their own weaknesses. And I think that's important. But I don't necessarily mean the actual man himself.
But he also believes very strongly in what he's doing, and what he did really was revolutionary at the time.
Absolutely. I mean, I suppose also there's the aspect that because of the subject that he was working on, it's something that every single person is having to deal with every day of their life, which, you know, they might be very... people who are into Mozart's music and are very affected by, you know, how he revolutionized opera and music. I would imagine there's more people dealing with sex and sexuality than there are dealing with classical music. So maybe that's what I meant. I don't know.
You're listed as a producer in some of the segments. What do you do in that capacity?
Well, I'm a producer on the show, not on some of the segments. I work on script. I work with the writers. Because I'm at the heart of the production when we're actually filming, I feel like I have sort of an insight into the mechanics of how it actually works on the studio floor and how the pieces get put together. So we all work very collaboratively on it, and that's one of the great pleasures of the show.
And now you're directing Under Milkwood. Do you want to do more directing?
Well, I've directed quite a few things in the past. I mentioned the Passion earlier on, and that was an extraordinary experience where I went back to my hometown and did a one-off live performance that lasted non-stop for 72 hours that involved 2,000 of the local people and eventually was described as the theatrical event of the decade. So I feel like I have dipped my toe into directing.
And now this Sunday, the 92nd Street Y will be celebrating Dylan Thomas's centenary with Michael Sheen directing and performing in a performance of Under Milkwood. It will be broadcast live by the BBC Radio Wales coming this Sunday at 3 p.m. And 92Y will also live stream the audio online. WNYC will offer an encore broadcast and webcast on Sunday, November 2nd. Michael Sheen, thank you so much for being on our show today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.